Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about government procurement and acquisition, how it is the government buys things, and particularly we'll be concentrating on how it is that the Department of Defense buys things like trucks and planes and uniforms and sidearms, just about anything that you could think of. Back at the end of February, when the Air Force announced that it had awarded a $35 billion contract for aerial refueling planes to a European company, there was a great outcry in Washington and on Capitol Hill. Supporters of Boeing, which was also competing for the same contract, immediately objected. They argued that this should have been awarded to an American company, a company that would build these planes with American workers for the United States. And that, in our minds, raised a question. When the government makes a purchase, what is more important? Is it more important that we get the most for the taxpayer's dollar, or is it more important that we protect American jobs? In this part of the program, we'll be talking with someone who was the top procurement official in the Pentagon during the Clinton administration. His name is Jacques Gansler, and he is now a professor in public policy and private enterprise at the University of Maryland. He's been good enough to spend a little time with us this morning talking about perhaps about this particular case, but in a more general way about how it is the government buys things and what we have tried to do over time to make sure that indeed we were getting the most for our money. Let me tell you this a little bit more about our guest. He is former Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. He was the third-ranking civilian in the Pentagon from 1997 until 2001 and was responsible for all research and development, acquisition reform, logistics, advanced technology, environmental security, defense industry, and a lot of other programs as well. Now, before joining the Clinton administration, he also held a variety of positions in government and also in the private sector. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Material Acquisition. He was Assistant Director of Defense Research and Engineering for Electronics. He also had positions in several companies, including ITT, Singer, and Raytheon. He is, by his training, both an electrical engineer and an economist, and he's joining us this morning by phone, and we appreciate him giving us some of his time. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief in their comments so that we can keep our program moving along. But, of course, anyone who's interested in calling in is welcome. Dr. Gansler, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Okay.
Well, you know, there's a lot that we can talk about, but the thing that really started us thinking about this was indeed all of the coverage and the controversy surrounding the deal on the air tankers.
Sure.
And I don't know, you know, how much weight this can bear as a case study, but I am interested in your reaction to this. The contract was awarded to the European Aeronautic Defense and Space Company. These are the people who make Airbus.
Well, actually not.
Okay. Well, maybe if that's not quite right, you correct me then.
Let me highlight the because that perception is the one that many in Congress, in fact, have been trying to project.
Okay.
The award is actually awarded to the Northrop Grumman with the Airbus or European EADS company as the basic designer of that Airbus. But the Northrop, the U.S. company, is going to be doing final assembly and building of the modifications required for the Airbus in order to make it into a tanker. That's going to be done in Alabama primarily and built in U.S. by U.S. workers. And what it does is it introduces a potential competition to Boeing from Northrop in Alabama, which from the viewpoint of the government, as you pointed out earlier, does represent the potential benefits of competition, namely innovation and lower cost, which is the basis for trying to encourage that the Defense Department gets the best goods at the lowest cost. In the absence of competition of that sort, then you will have typically monopoly pricing and lack of innovation. That's what's behind the idea of introducing a potential competitor. But it is important, as you pointed out, that American jobs also be considered. And in fact, it's by coincidence, the Airbus happens to have a lot of U.S. subsystems already in it. So some of the stuff goes from the U.S. over to Europe and then back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. But the final assembly of this tanker and the modifications required from a normal Airbus system into a Air Force tanker, those will all be made in the United States.
Well, I appreciate the clarification. It is confusing, and it certainly it was my and indeed it was my understanding that, in spite of the fact that Boeing said, "Well, you shouldn't. This is an American plane; it should be built by Americans," and members of Congress have certainly said the same thing. A lot of people in Congress have objected to this, including both Senators Clinton and Obama and a lot of other people in Congress, because of the jobs angle. The plane, in fact, the final assembly on the plane, as you say, will be done in Alabama. So, in fact, the American workers will be employed. A lot of American workers will indeed be employed in building this aircraft.
Right. And in fact, I think this is typical of the general recognition that globalization is, in fact, sometimes a benefit to America, sometimes in some particular employment, it'll have an adverse impact. In other words, there will be people in Wichita or Seattle who now aren't going to build that airplane, but instead there'll be people in Alabama and Florida who will be building the airplane. Mm-hmm. So there is a shifting necessity in a certain sense that comes about. But I might point out that in the Boeing airplanes, there are lots of foreign subsystems as well. And, of course, in the 787, Boeing has shifted a good deal of the sub work offshore. And this is simply a recognition that in many cases, you're not buying something because it's cheaper offshore. You're buying it because it's better and cheaper. Yeah. And that's what globalization is about. America needs to take advantage of and recognize the benefits of globalization, not just the adverse effects of it.
Mm-hmm. And you just, again, to underscore with another thing that you said, and again, it was my understanding, just simply based on what I have read, it would appear, indeed, that the Air Force made the choice to go with this plane built by Northrop Grumman based on the Airbus design. Essentially,
yes.
I guess what they're doing is they're taking the Airbus, the passenger airplane, and they're retooling that to make this tanker. And I guess there are some other applications for that plane as well. It seems to be the case that the Air Force made the choice both based on the fact that they thought that would be a better plane and that Northrop Grumman said that they could turn the planes out at a greater rate. That is, they could produce more planes in a particular amount of time. So it looks as if, in fact, this was a case where the Air Force said, well, this is the better plane, and that's where we want to spend our money.
Well, it's a combination of a better plane and the attractiveness of both schedule and cost. Those are all considerations, mm-hmm. and even cost, when doing it properly, the evaluation would consider not just initial cost, but also life cycle cost. In other words, how much fuel is going to get used, how many people are involved, and so forth. So the Air Force had to do a evaluation comparing the two on the basis of a wide variety of considerations, the same way that you and I would buy, if we were going to try and buy a car, you know, we wouldn't necessarily always buy the very cheapest car. I mean, otherwise everybody here would be buying those little cars that are now buzzing around in Europe, or a Yugo from, you know, Europe or something. We do an evaluation of a combination of best what's called best value of performance and cost and utilization. Now, increasingly, we're all looking towards fuel economies and trying to buy cars that are environmentally friendly. So all these considerations we bring into our buying process, the Air Force needs to bring into the buying process for buying a tanker.
Well, let me ask this because, and I think this, no doubt this becomes increasingly difficult with globalization because it has become increasingly difficult to say about a particular product, what is an American made, what is an American product and what is not, because things are made, pieces of things are made all over and things are assembled all over and companies have interests all over, and it becomes increasingly difficult to say, all right, if you're determined to buy American, what exactly does that mean? But in this particular case, say we're buying things for the Department of Defense, how difficult is that? And in fact, is there some kind of requirement that you do buy American or something that in content is primarily American?
Well, there are laws require us to look at that, and then there is good judgment that requires us to look at that. So there's security considerations, for example, that says, well, if they stop supplying it, would that cut us off on something that we badly need? So you do consider whether you are vulnerable just or not, simply because you're buying from somebody doesn't make you vulnerable, but you might be, and then you have to consider that. Certainly that's a consideration. But then there are also laws, so-called Buy America laws, that require certain things to be made in America. A certain percentage of the product come from America. Certain special steels have to come from America. Certain cloths have to come from America, so forth. These are laws that the Congress passes, which in fact increase the cost and in many cases even reduce the quality of the goods, but they are done for purely political reasons. And these are the trade-offs that the government has to make. In some cases, the Congress should make between increases in national security versus a job in the United States. So those are very difficult choices. But certainly the same thing with getting higher performance from, say, a foreign product that you might buy versus buying one in the United States. And what increasingly is happening, and what has happened in the case of the tanker, is that you can take a design from offshore and still build it in the United States. And that's what's basically happening here. There are lots of subsystems on the Airbus that come from the United States anyhow, but then the final assembly is also being done here. And then when people look at that overall product, both at the final assembly and at the subsystem level, they want to make sure they're not going to be vulnerable in terms of being cut off from any sources of supply. That's a security consideration. Then there's an economic and a political consideration relative to jobs and things like that that people do have to consider and do consider.
And just one more question, and I have a caller here I want to get to. I promise this person I won't make them wait forever. Over time, is the when you look at the things that, say again, we'll just say the Department of Defense buys, has there been an increase in foreign content over domestic content?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And there's also been a significant shift from products to services. Those changes are taking place because, in the case of the foreign content, it's because the world is globalized. But on the other hand, the majority, overwhelming majority of the products that the Defense Department buys are clearly still U.S.-made, in some cases foreign-designed, and want to take advantage of if they're better designs. And in some cases, some of the parts go in that historically over the last, I'd say, 20, 30 years even, almost every weapon system has had some foreign parts in them because they're the better parts or they're available to put into our systems, but then we would pre-stock them so we didn't become dependent on them. I would say there is an increasing percentage of the systems that are offshore designed. The presidential helicopter has been mentioned as another example. It would be built here, but it's a foreign design. The Army armed helicopter program recently, same thing, being built here, offshore design. The Navy's recent selection of a small ship program being built here actually by two different U.S. contractors, but two different foreign designs. So increasingly that is the case as the world is becoming globalized and where U.S. doesn't necessarily have the lead in every single area. But we are concerned very much with where it's built, who the workers are, and the vulnerability potential aspects from security. So those are all considered.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jacques Gansler. He is professor in public policy and private enterprise at the University of Maryland and is a former undersecretary of defense for acquisition. He, in fact, was the top procurement official in the Pentagon during the Clinton administration. This was from 1997 until 2001. And we're talking here about military government procurement and acquisition. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have someone here to talk with in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Interesting topic. My question has been partly answered here in the last few minutes, but I'll I'll review it again and see if there's some more information. My worry is not whose plane, whose design it is and where it's built or that kind of thing. My worry would be, as far as spare parts, obviously some of the subsystems are built in Europe. And I know in the case of certain other military aircraft where there has been some flaws in the aircraft, and then the aircraft has had to be completely rebuilt. I'm talking about some UA helicopters that I was involved with, that assembly line was actually set up to put modifications on, and I'm sure that the government was able to put pressure on the manufacturer to do that in an expedient way. If we do need, if there's some parts problems, how is that addressed, that if some subassemblies that turn out to be somewhat flawed need to be rebuilt in a hurry, and other parts, it seems to me like it would be a lot harder to pressure a foreign manufacturer to change production schedules and all that it entails to do that kind of thing. And you did address this somewhat, but I did hear, that was my question, so...
No, that's a very good question, and it's an important consideration in deciding on the parts you're going to be using. And one of the things that clearly has been done is you pre-stock a number of the parts under the assumption that it is the same part. Another thing which has been done is often to try to establish a U.S. potential source, that in the event that there's any reason for A, redesign, or B, the lack of supply, if the foreign government decides they are not interested in supplying it for one reason or another, or they disagree with our policies or something of that sort, then you want to make sure you're not cut off. And so you want to have a so-called backup solution with a U.S. supplier. Now, you may end up in some cases having to accept a slightly inferior product in terms of performance, but it certainly has to still work. And you want to make sure that you have that alternative. Another thing which is frequently done, is if you are dependent on a particular supplier of a particular product that is currently the state of the art, you might want to fund the next generation part to be developed in the United States, so that you have now a company that is pushing the state of the art in that area, if that's a critical technology, and that at some point they will become the supplier because they're better. And or because they're much less expensive. They might change. When you change, you could either change the product or you could change the process. If you want to make a more reliable or lower cost part, you might have to change the process to do that. And you would like to have that alternative being developed, and preferably within the United States.
Well, it's refreshing to know that at least that's part of the consideration. So thank you for the answer.
All right. Well, thank you. Other questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We have another caller here where we are in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have one quick question. If it were a different country other than Germany, if it were, or Northrop Grumman, I assume, is Germany, let's say Canada or the U.K. or somebody who we have super favorable relationships, not that we don't with Germany, but if it were a company or a country other than Germany, would that be even an issue for our administration?
Well, in fact, we're now working on we have an agreement, in a sense, with Canada that says we will treat the Canadian industrial base as part of the U.S. industrial base. We still have export control provisions that are applied to Canada, but in terms of the industrial base, defense industrial base considerations, they tend to be treated, as you suggest, as part of a dependable supplier. We are now in the negotiations, in fact, to have a signed treaty with the United Kingdom, treating them somewhat in the same way as we've been treating Canada. And there are negotiations underway with Australia as a possible extension of that because, again, extremely highly reliable, work with us closely on intelligence work and so forth in Australia. Now,
they're predominantly, English-speaking.
Well, that's the point I was just going to get at. Now, those those two are clear, or those three, Canada and UK and Australia, not only are English-speaking, but are long-term special relations kinds of countries. Now, we are developing that in an expanded fashion, and we think it should be done in an expanded fashion with a lot of other countries that have been both reliable in terms of third country exports and controls and things like that, and also dependable as allies in support of us in expeditionary operations or in other things. So I think in the longer term, as globalization expands as a concept and as we treat it in the security environment in somewhat the same way we've been treating in the economic environment, I think we will incorporate other countries in terms of their dependency. Now, one of the things that we obviously recognize is that there is an interdependency here, so that if a country is dependent on us for things, then it's a lot safer for us to be dependent on them. But nonetheless, I think overall, you still want to worry about potential vulnerabilities. And that's why I made the points earlier about the importance of considering vulnerabilities as you're negotiating these agreements.
Right. So then, assumably, you would assume that probably most of the parts or a good deal of the parts are made in China, but you would never, ever have, an actual plane or tank or whatever come out of China.
Well, I think as of now, certainly that's the case. What it'll be in 40 or 50 years, I'd rather have China as a friend than an enemy. But for the near term, certainly there are no plans to have any of our equipment being built in China. Or I could list a few other countries that I wouldn't want to be dependent upon.
I just have one quick last question. Are Hummers American-made?
The Hummer is American-made, but I would be willing to bet. I haven't looked at the Hummer. I've looked at most weapon systems. I haven't looked at the Hummer because, obviously, that's a commercial and military system. I'd be willing to bet that there are a lot of pieces and parts that are not originally from the U.S., but the final assembly is done here.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go on here to another caller, and this is someone in Champaign and on line two. Hello.
Yes, I have a more general question about military procurement. I used to study the Armed Services Procurement Manual.
Boy, that's a dull one.
Say again?
Say that's an interesting reading.
Oh, it was. It was my death knell as an Army JAG officer. But anyway, there used to be a principle that we were told that is an award of government contracts should be made to the lowest, most responsible, responsive bidder. To sort of arrive at the situation you seem to have characterized the Boeing Grumman Northrop situation, the cheapest bidder who could do it the best and the most reliable. My question, however, is that what really puzzles me about applying that rule, and maybe there is some exception to it now in the Iraqi theater, is that I've heard about these no-bid contracts, cost-plus contracts, that have been let out, have been issued by the government to Halliburton and to others, and it looks like we're getting ripped off there because we're not following those basic government procurement policies that I learned several years ago. Am I right about that? Is there an exception where we have no-bid, cost-plus contracts that really put the Treasury of the United States at risk? So that's what bothers me about government contracting in that context. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. No, I'd be happy to, because I think that you raise an important point. Let me take the first comment, though, about taking simply the lower bid. I think the old model of where you simply say, I have identical products and I'm going to then take the low bid, open the envelope, and the low bid wins, that applies when you have similar products. When you have differentiated products, such as we were talking about earlier about the tanker, clearly the Airbus and the Boeing tanker proposals were differentiated products, then you have to do a total best value in their performance versus cost versus delivery versus reliability and so forth. That's all consistent with the Federal Acquisition Regulations, as you point out. It's more of a best value than low bid price. Now, when you go to something like the service support in Iraq, the Halliburton example that you gave, that's a different environment. First of all, it is services. Secondly, They have been awarded on a long-term competitive basis originally, but then the add-ons are done, as you point out, on a sole-source basis. I think that the Army has actually recognized in that case that they need to go to more of a competitive environment. So that contract has actually been recompeted so that in the future they will have multiple people they could go to rather than having to simply go to the same one each time. Unfortunately, that's right now being held up in protests. And once that gets resolved, they could go to Company A or Company B with each of the awards instead of having to keep going back to the original winner, which in this case was the Halliburton subcontractor. And so Halliburton, or I guess a wholly owned subsidiary, not a subcontractor, Halliburton then was getting all of these contracts on a follow-on, in effect, to the bid that they originally won. And there was a reason for doing that was because there's an urgency, and it has to be expedited. You know, the general says, I want a new tent city built by tomorrow afternoon, and you can't then go through a six-month competition and a six-month source selection. You have to have somebody right there. But the new process will then have two or three people right there that can give you bids, and then you can pick the lower of those bids, the process that you're recommending.
Correct.
I should highlight the fact that the percent profit on the Halliburton contract is actually very low. I think it was 1%, which is a low. But on the other hand, as you pointed out, if the cost keeps going up, 1% of a big number is still a big number.
Right.
And therefore, you do want to control the costs themselves, and that's one of the main changes that they're trying to introduce now so that that sole source environment goes away.
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, thanks for the call. And I guess maybe I should mention, for the benefit of that caller and anybody else that was listening, you actually served as the chairman of a Pentagon commission and made a report last fall, I believe, in fact, looking at this business of how it is that contracting was being done to supply material for Iraq, for Afghanistan, and indeed you found that there were a number of problems.
Yes, in fact, I spent 2 hours yesterday morning testifying for the House Armed Services Committee on that. The fortunate news is that Secretary Gates and Secretary Guerin, the Secretary of the Army, both have taken that commission report and are fully moving out to implement it, which is the good news. There really was an absence of sufficient attention to the contracting area on these expeditionary operations. And so we recommended a number of significant changes that they are actually starting to implement now, and I'm pleased with that.
Mm. Well, just I have other callers who I get it right too, but just overall, this is a subject that certainly is not new, and people perhaps will remember going back into the 1980s, the stories we heard about the military spending $435 to buy a hammer and $640 to buy a toilet seat, you know,
right.
Those things we could go down to the big box store and pick up for less than $10, and clearly there was a problem. There was a problem with fraud and waste in the way that we spent our money and what we were getting for our money. Do you think that today that things, you can say that things are better, maybe not perfect, but are better?
Well, in fact, I took part in that the Packard Commission, which at that time with the overpriced toilet seats and hammers and so forth. And if you look back at the type of changes that were desired, they were institutional structural changes that actually came out of the subsequent legislation, the Goldwater-Nichols bill, that made real structural changes as a result. That was very positive. On the other hand, that was also the result of living through a period in the Reagan buildup when we had a lot of money, and so when money's flowing loosely, you do tend to get sometimes abuses. What has happened in the post-Cold War period, we had a significant decline in the defense budget and the defense procurement budget. About $100 billion came out of the budget, about $60 billion of that being procurement. And they cut back significantly on the number of people and the level of the officers, for example, they used to have, in 1990, they had five general officers in the Army with contracting background. Today they have zero. That was the sort of thing that we found with the commission that needs to be changed. And then in the post 9/11 period, the budget skyrocketed, and we, of course, we went off to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we got these $100 billion supplementals, and there weren't enough people or attention being paid to it. And it was, in a sense, living in a rich man's world where if you want something, you just pay for it. And that's an environment in which there's an opportunity for significant abuse. And that's why I think we've been finding some of the situations of fraud and other things happening, waste. And that needs to be corrected, and that's what this commission was addressing. So to answer your question, I think we learned a lot from that earlier period, and the corrections that were taken at that time have been implemented, but now we've got to learn also from the recent events and take some corrective actions to those.
All right. We're a little bit past our midpoint. I have some other callers here, but I do want to introduce once again the guest for this hour, Jacques Gansler. He was the top procurement official in the Pentagon during the Clinton administration. He was Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. He was the third-ranking civilian at the Pentagon from 1997 until 2001. He has had a number of positions in government and the private sector. He was vice president of ITT and engineering and management, had engineering and management positions with both Singer and Raytheon. He is currently professor in public policy and private enterprise at the University of Maryland, where he's also director of the Center for Public Policy and Private Enterprise. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We are going into about our last 20 minutes here, and our lines are full. So again, callers will help us by trying to keep their questions brief. Let us go next to talk with someone in Rockford, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gansler, a few years ago, I do recall reading something in the Wall Street Journal or something about Boeing losing out on a plane contract because there was fraud and waste. The thing was overpriced. And I noticed that with this thing coming on, this tanker thing, I've yet to hear anything about that in the past. Is my memory serving me correctly about Boeing overpricing a plane for the Army a few years back?
The thing that you remember, Boeing did get into trouble, but it was actually not so much from overpricing. It was from the fact that there were some improper actions taken. One of the Air Force officials, Darlene Druyan specifically, was working deals, in effect, for future employment and ended up going to jail over it. And then the chief financial officer of Boeing also went to jail over that arrangement. And as a result, Boeing canceled. There were some programs that had been planned to go to Boeing on a sole source basis, which therefore the implication of your question is normally sole source pricing is a little higher. Therefore, that program was canceled, and it was then recompeted, and that's the current tanker program, which we were talking about at the beginning of the program.
Okay, well, my memory served me. Look,
yeah.
Thanks so much, and as long as we watch things, hopefully our inflation won't get too high. Have a good one.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go back here to someone local, and that'll be someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. Actually, the gentleman before just mentioned the thing about the Boeing lease contract for the 767 tanker. The Economist had an article about a month or two ago after the tanker contract was awarded to Airbus, and according to them, the tanker that Airbus makes is much more sophisticated and actually works for the Air Force better due to its avionics, and the 767 was old technology, and the reason that Boeing was so upset about it was because, of course, you know, it's they pulled this pro-American bull. And the 767 line was going to be shut down anyway because the aircraft was being discontinued. So do you think, I think the Americans got a better deal on this, according to the Economist. Now, whether that's, you know, because it's a European publication or not. But on the Boeing thing, you were talking about the guy going to jail. That was a somewhat of a specious thing anyway because they were going to lease tankers to the Air Force on the 767 model. And I find that real interesting, but another thing, I'm really happy that you're in this business because we need people like you who can look over these, basically the theft of American dollars by companies that are basically could care less about. I mean, they see this opportunity with 9/11 and this anti-terrorism canard, and they basically have racked up the budget by the defense budget by 50%. I mean, the nuclear weapons are off budget. They're in a separate budget. The Energy Department or something. And then you have this whole canard, this whole joke in Iraq where, 200,000 AK-47s are missing and billions of dollars unaccounted for. And it's just, it's a boondoggle of staggering proportions. Thanks for letting me politicize, but I appreciate your work. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I don't know, you want to comment on that in any way?
Well, no, I think his first part of the statements are certainly true in terms of the 767 being older technology. One of the arguments Boeing was making was that this would extend the production line. And I think he's right in the Economist quote that basically the Air Force was trying to make a best value judgment between the two systems. As far as the abuse that's been taking place in Iraq that he mentioned, it's clear that needs to be corrected, and that's what we were just talking about relative to the commission's recommendations for change.
All right, let's go to another caller here in Champaign County where we are. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, one of the things is I wanted to bring up was this scandal, and it seems like there should be some punishment for Boeing. One of the ramifications that hasn't been mentioned, and he didn't go to jail, was that Richard Pearl, one of the architects of the New American Century, was also taking money lobbying for Boeing's leasing program. I think he was forced to resign from the military, some advisory board, but I think he stayed on for a while. So that's just a pretty surreal highlight to the whole military-industrial complex, I guess. I'm interested in a further discussion of this, and maybe somebody from Corp Watch, so one of the main writers for that, is actually on the ground in Iraq now investigating military procurement at the base level, basically. So that's just a future discussion idea. One other comment just on the idea of the Halliburton's profit is only 1%. With so many shell corporations and them not even paying regular taxes, I think they have a lot of places to hide money that doesn't show up maybe in their profit margin. And just a question, what do you feel about the current atmosphere of whistleblowers? Because I think that's one of the most important and scandalous things going on. The Congress has had some kind of legislation protecting whistleblowers, not just in military procurement and the Defense Department waste, but all through the government, and it's just not seeming to be able to go ahead with anything that would really protect people when they want to blow a whistle.
Okay. Well, let me comment on those four points you raised very briefly, though. First one, which was the punishments for the people involved, both the government official and the Boeing official both went to jail. The thing I would emphasize is that that's not a typical case. I think the last one of those literally happened at the time of the overpriced toilet seats and hammers. There were also an official who happened by coincidence to have come from Boeing and then was in the Navy, I think, at the time, and he also ended up in jail. But that was in 1986, I think. So, the fact that we've had a 20-year period with only two of these, I think, is very positive. As far as the on-site procurements in Iraq, your point is absolutely right. We needed more people there who could do the contracting in an expeditionary fashion right there. The problem was trying to get people, civilians, government officials particularly, to go there on a volunteer basis with no added incentives, and that was one of the things that, in fact, I testified yesterday to the Congress that I think is wrong. Those civilian volunteers need to get some of the benefits that both contractors and the military get when they go overseas, such as life insurance coverage and medical, major medical, and even tax benefits, so forth. The fact that this stuff is being done, offshore, is understandable. That's where the war is taking place, and clearly, I think that's going to have to change in terms of we need people who are in the military wearing uniforms in an expeditionary operation at senior levels who can make decisions of this sort. I guess the last point you were making about whistleblowers, clearly the Congress has been an advocate for the whistleblower, and I think will continue to be so. This is a necessary oversight. In fact, they get rewarded very heavily, so there is a huge incentive for them to do it, and it does keep people, I think, on the up and up on both government and industry sides.
It just, when one thinks about how many things, say, just the Department of Defense, how many individual items they buy, and how many people are involved simply in trying to make sure that we have the things that we need, it seems truly staggering. So the idea of oversight seems rather staggering as well.
Well, it depends on how you define oversight. I mean, when you write a contract to buy something, and if you just walk away, I mean, it would be like you were building a house, and you decided to, okay, John Doe's going to take care of it. I'll go on a two-year vacation, and when I come back, my house will be finished. I don't think you'd feel comfortable doing that. I think you'd want somebody managing, overseeing it, making sure that it did turn out the way you had expected it to, with the performance you had expected for the cost you had expected, that it's not being charged for things that you're not getting and so forth. So that's the kind of oversight that I think is necessary. We call that program management or contract management, and that's, I think, where we have not been doing enough of it in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan in recent years, and that's the part that needs to be beefed up significantly.
Well, let's talk with someone else. I have another caller here. This is in Champaign and in line one.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling mostly just to make a comment. I don't really have a question. I have felt this for so long now, and I'm wondering where Americans are and where their voices are. I don't know about anybody else, but all of this makes me so angry and so sad that our country has behaved the way it behaved, has done the things it's done, and I wonder where everybody's anger is. Your voice is so calm. This does not make me feel calm. This makes me feel so angry. Do you ever hear that from anyone?
Yes, I heard it yesterday when I testified in the House Armed Services Committee, and properly. These abuses should have been stopped 5 years ago in the case of our expeditionary operations in Iran and Afghanistan. It is disturbing that it was allowed to continue, and so I am upset by that. But I am pleased by the fact that now the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Army are stepping up to it and starting to take action, and that the Congress is very supportive of that, which I am pleased with.
Yeah, I just wish more citizens, regular citizens, would speak up. I think we're the supporting block that's been missing a long time for getting things done. Well, thank you very much for what you're doing.
Thank you. And again, other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just again, very quickly to introduce our guest, Jacques Gantzler. He is professor in public policy and private enterprise at University of Maryland in the Clinton administration. He was the third-ranking civilian in the Pentagon. This was from 1997 until 2001. He was an undersecretary of defense for acquisition technology and logistics. So he was the top procurement official in the Pentagon during the Clinton administration, and also has had other positions in government as well, and in private enterprise. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm just curious, you know, it seemed to me that the first time that I can remember, and actually this wasn't something that happened just very recently, but that this whole issue of buying American for the military seemed, the first time I remember this really being a big issue was at the point where the Department of Defense decided that they were going to replace what had been for a very, very long time the standard sidearm for the military, which was a 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol, that they were going to replace that. And eventually the contract was awarded to Beretta, which is a very old Italian arms manufacturer. And so DOD bought the large numbers of Beretta 9mm. Now, and I guess that there's, again, right now we're in the process of deciding, are we going to have a new gun? And I suppose that's the kind of thing for people who have been in the military is kind of an emotional and personal attachment to their personal weapons. Were you in and around the Pentagon at the time that that whole change was made?
Actually, it's one of the case studies that I now teach at the University of Maryland is the Beretta acquisition. It is an interesting case, and it does very much involve the Buy America question, but it also ended up being built in New York State on, again, a foreign design. But it was the emotional involvement, as you suggest, of, well, gee, that's a foreign design. You know, how can we do that instead of an American design? But if it's better, you choose to use their design, and if you're worried about vulnerability, you can build it in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
And that case is now similar to what we are looking at with the tanker or looking at with the presidential helicopter or other examples.
Well, I know that I believe now that there is this may be up for discussion again. I believe that Smith and Wesson is thinking very seriously, or maybe more than just thinking, is preparing to compete again for that kind of contract. But just looking at how this worked out for the military, how the Beretta have worked, do you think that it has turned out to have been a good choice?
I have no reason for not thinking so. I haven't heard, you know, lots of complaints about it, but on the other hand, that was a decision made years ago, and the state of the art has changed, so it would be appropriate to reevaluate it. But there was a lot of discussion at that time also about whether everybody should use the same gun, you know, or whether you should have a lighter weight gun for smaller and lighter people and a big heavy gun for big people, and whether the Air Force should have the same gun as the Army has and so forth. Those kind of debates still go on all the time.
Well, that's, I suppose that is indeed another one of the features of military contracting that becomes difficult. I expect that the Berettas that the military are carrying, it's the same one that anybody could go out and buy, but that... I'm sure that within the military, within the different branches, they think differently, and they might think, well, there's some special application here we'd really need, and that maybe the Marines think that they should have one sidearm, and the Air Force thinks they should have one, and the Navy thinks that they should have one. And that's one of the reasons why we end up spending so much money, because the different service branches say that they have unique requirements, and or perhaps they just all want to have their own, and so that means rather this is in a sense a hypothetical example that we would have to have, you know, four different handguns, and somehow we couldn't just make do with the same one and have everybody carry the same one.
Sure, no, that's a very common problem. It's somewhat being alleviated by the fact that now there's much more emphasis on the fact that we fight together in the jointness environment. In other words, it's no longer that the Air Force fights in the air and the Navy fights on the sea and the Army fights on the land, but now we recognize that this is an integrated operation with Air Force sensors and Navy missiles coming from offshore and Army, you know, integrating all of this. And so now people realize that interoperability becomes very critical, and once you get to that point, then you start thinking about more common items. The other issue that comes up in the case you're just talking about is, how about buying commercial stuff? In many cases in the past, the Defense Department was way ahead of the commercial world on technology. Today, in many areas like information technology, in many cases the commercial world is ahead of the military. So now can we buy the commercial one? Well, the first thing that the military will say, well, the Navy will say it doesn't handle salt spray, you know, and they'll come up with specialized requirements, which then will cause you to redesign a perfectly good commercial item to be able to meet what is perceived as a unique military need but may double the cost. And maybe there's some arguments for saying, well, we ought to be taking full advantage of commercial technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do about that? I think that's a perfect example, because someone would say, if for example, you're wanting to buy computers, you can go out and buy perfectly good computers off the shelf, the same one that anybody would go and buy. So why is it, you know, how do you deal with a military that says, well, you know, that's fine, that's a good computer, but this is our applications are different, or the conditions under which we use them are going to be different, and for that reason we've got to have something that's much different than that, or better than that, or hardened, or, you know, whatever it is that they say that they've got to have.
Well, the way you would do that, in a certain sense, is the same way you might do it in the commercial world, but hasn't traditionally been done in military, namely worry about how much those add-ons cost. if I'm going to so-called gold plate at something, and it doubles the cost, and the marginal gain in performance isn't that great, you say, well, we can't afford that. Now, in the last 6 years, in this rich man's world, we can afford anything. You know, the defense budget just keeps skyrocketing, and add another $100 billion supplemental every year or so, and that takes care of it. But when the budget most likely is going to be flattening out, people are going to be starting to be concerned about how much things actually cost, and cost becomes an important consideration. So for all these extra things I'd like to have, you now have to price them out. Some of them you really do need. Other cases, you just like to have them, and you can't afford them. And it's a cost constraint that is the thing that hopefully will put some restraint into the desires of how much we're going to be spending in the future.
Well, there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Jacques Ansler. He's a professor in public policy and private enterprise at the University of Maryland. He's also director of the Center for Public Policy and Private Enterprise. He was, during the Clinton administration, the top procurement official in the Pentagon, serving as Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics. And Dr. Ansler, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.